Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. A sacred fire is burning at Queen's Park to urge the province of Ontario to stop development in Ottawa's South March Highlands, and Meshkagawa Council Grand Chief Stan Lutet says discrepancies found in a treaty commissioner's diary in the early 1900s will help them negotiate with government. And organic farming is helping reduce child poverty and unemployment rates on a couple of First Nation communities in Saskatchewan. Elsewhere, the 20th Annual Women's Memorial March is just around the bend. The Valentine's Day event is expected to be the largest yet, especially for organizers downtown Vancouver. And Matt Eiserhoff of multi-genre band Ceremony spoke with Bomsida about their nomination for a 2011 Juno. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A sacred fire is burning at Queen's Park in Toronto. It's in support to urge the province of Ontario to stop development in the South March Highlands near Ottawa. Daniel Amakwabi Bernard is an Algonquin firekeeper who helped initiate the sacred fire at Queen's Park to draw awareness to the issue. He says the area is ecologically important.
This forest is absolutely extremely important. This forest has been located where its location. It has been, the government had already had it as a important, significant area of sciences and research, and the significance of the forest is important because it's the most ecological area within a city in the world. It's the only city that has this wilderness within a city in the world.
Bernard says closing ceremonies will be held on Sunday morning at Queen's Park, where respected and renowned elder William Commando will address participants. Bernard says they'll also be hoping that Ontario Minister of Tourism and Culture Michael Chan will attend and also speak to the issue. And Bridge continues to face opposition against its Northern Gateway Pipeline project. The Black Press reports members of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation demonstrated against the project during an Enbridge community meeting earlier this month. They declared Enbridge officials as trespassers on the traditional territory of the Yankee Dene people. Chief Karen Ogan reaffirmed that 61 First Nations were opposed to the project. Meanwhile, Enbridge officials at the meeting said the company did have some First Nations cooperation and suggested First Nation protesters were presenting their declaration to the wrong pipeline company. Meantime, the Calgary Herald reports Enbridge will also be offering First Nations along the proposed pipeline route hundreds of millions of dollars. The company will be offering the affected Indigenous communities about $380 million in income over three decades. The compensation package is based on a 10% equity interest in the pipeline. The paper also reports that 8 of 40 First Nations have agreed to look into the benefits package. Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs Grand Chief Ron Evans has told senators to forget about regulating water standards on First Nations. He says instead, systems need to be built to bring safe drinking water to all First Nations. Evans was giving testimony at the Senate Committee on Aboriginal Peoples on February 9th. Evans told the committee that legislation to regulate drinking water on reserves will do nothing to solve the water crises that have left thousands of people on Northern Manitoba First Nations without running water. According to the Winnipeg Free Press, the committee is holding hearings on Bill S-11, which aims to develop federal regulations on drinking water on reserves. First Nations oppose the bill because it doesn't include funding to build the water systems needed, plus a proposed law could make First Nations responsible for impossible standards. The paper also reports Conservative Senator Patrick Brazeau was highly critical of Evans and the other chiefs who testified. Brazeau said all he heard from the chiefs was whining about lack of consultation on the legislation. As of December, 117 First Nations were under drinking water advisories. First Nations leaders in Ontario want the rest of the country to know that Conservative Senator Patrick Brazeau is not a legitimate representative of First Nations. APTN reports 9 Ontario chiefs representing tribal and band councils signed a letter on February 8th. The letter states that identifying Brazeau as a representative of Indigenous leaders in Ontario violated the human rights of First Nations in the province. The letter also states that Senator Brazeau was never elected to lead or to represent a First Nation in Canada. The letter points out that under international law and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Indigenous peoples have a right to maintain their own distinct political, legal, economic, social, and cultural institutions, and the right to choose their own representatives. Brazeau, however, has dismissed the letter as petty politics and says it stems from an exchange on a committee studying drinking water. The finding of the Diary of a Treaty Commissioner points out the discrepancies in a 1905 treaty and what was said between negotiators. James Bay Treaty No. 9 was signed in 1905. And Meshkegowat Council Grand Chief Stan Ludit says the diary from Daniel McMartin reveals some very interesting details.
We're finding that the treaty-making process was very, very, very different from what our people heard from the treaty commissioner's mouths, if you will.
Ludit points out the inconsistency between the diary and the treaty includes a clause on land use.
It says in the handwriting of the Ontario commissioner in his own personal diaries, it says at various places in the treaty making process in our territory, not just one place, but in various places all across the Treaty 9 area, it says you can hunt and fish and gather as in the days of yore, meaning as you always did. There's no buts. It stops there. It doesn't say, but if the government needs it, they can take it. It does not say that. It just confirms that we can do what we always did in our territories.
Ludit says the diary findings will help their position when negotiating with the government. The 20th annual Women's Memorial March is just around the bend. Perhaps the largest event on Valentine's Day will be held downtown Vancouver. Marlene George is the chairperson of the Women's Memorial March Committee. She says the march began 2 decades ago over the death of an Aboriginal woman.
In 1991, there was a murder of a sex trade worker, an Aboriginal sex trade worker on Powell Street in Vancouver, and her remains were distributed in various places around the community by a fellow that had murdered her. And her family had gone around and did a cleansing ceremony at each of the sites her remains were found. But for the community, it was the catalyst that moved them into action, and women had decided that they had enough of the violence and murders and assaults of women in the community. So they decided that they were going to hold march. The murder of the woman happened mid-January, and the march they decided was going to be held on February 14th.
Similar marches have been planned throughout Canada. The Mashgaday Organic Growers Co-op and Heifer International Canada are reducing unemployment on two First Nations and supplying healthy food. Joseph Munro is the Indigenous Peoples Coordinator for Heifer International. He says Heifer International has two projects, one on Mashgaday First Nation and the other on Flying Dust First Nation. Munro says the organization helps provide seeds and training, and the co-ops are to pass that on.
Heifer International is a partner, usually providing support in the area of seeds and some training and many of the other things that the other partners don't provide. We have a unique contribution in that respect, and our contribution is one that is like a living loan. In Heifer International, when we give a gift, we call it a gift in the contribution form. They sign a contract that will pass on the gift, having the same impact as the original gift had on them. So that's our unique contribution.
He adds, as the food co-ops grow, welfare and child poverty rates will be reduced.
So it's been advantageous for these groups, these co-ops, to take people right from the welfare rolls and by reduce unemployment immediately. As these co-ops grow and expand their market and expand their acres, they have the likely potential of eliminating unemployment on Western Canadian reserves.
Munro says the Mashgaday Co-op is concentrating on growing Indigenous foods like corn, beans, and squash. He adds potatoes are the cash crop for the co-op, and he says there are also plans to expand the organic potato farm. The First Nations Fisheries Council in BC is unhappy with the issuance of aquaculture licenses in December. The organization says issuing those licenses was a clear infringement on rights and title of many BC First Nations. Ken Malloway, co-chair of the Fisheries Council, says First Nations have not received information from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans about existing licenses or what will be issued in traditional territories. The Fisheries Council had been working with DFO to increase opportunities for BC First Nations to contribute and participate in the development of the new Pacific aquaculture regulations. The Anishinaabeg Nation is accusing a federal government agency of ignoring the rule of law by approving the shipment of nuclear waste through their territories without notification. Grand Council Chief Patrick Madabi says the Supreme Court has stipulated the requirement for consultation and accommodation with First Nations. He says First Nations have to be accommodated on activities that could have an impact on their traditional territories. Madabi's comments come after the Anishinaabeg Nation learned that the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission decided earlier this month to authorize Bruce Power to transport 16 decommissioned steam generators from southwestern Ontario to Sweden for recycling. Matt Iserhoff of band Symphony is honored to have been nominated for a 2011 Juno for Best Aboriginal Recording of the Year.
We're obviously really humbled by the Juno nomination. It's quite an amazing step for the group, and you know, we wish to congratulate all the other nominees in that particular category.
Ceremony is a multi-genre band, and songs on their self-titled album go from rap to rock to reggae. And Matt says it was their purpose to create songs in multiple genres because he says it doesn't matter what the genre is, it's about what they want to convey through their music.
In the valley, there will be peace. In the valley, there will be peace. In the valley for me, there will be love. In this family, there will be in this family for me. There will be light on this journey. There will be light on this journey. There will be light on this journey for me. But if I want peace in the valley, if I want love in this family, if I want light on this journey, it's up to me. 'Cause I am the peace, I am the love, I am the light, the light I seek.
That was Andrea Menard with Peace from her CD, Simple Steps. A sacred fire is burning at Queen's Park in Toronto. It was lit February 9th and is to continue burning until Sunday, February 13th. Daniel Amakwabi Bernard is the firekeeper and organizer of the event. He says the group wants development of the South March Highlands to stop.
We had a sacred fire in the forest that's being massacred as we speak. The sacred forest is located in Kanata, Ottawa. And we had a sacred fire started there on the 19th of January, and it burned 24 hours a day until the 30th of January. And as an altar for people to come and ponder over what's going on and trying to find ways to reach the government officials, to reach their heart in stopping the massacre that's currently happening there.
So why don't you tell us a bit about the forest that that you want to bring awareness to?
Yes, absolutely. This this forest is absolutely extremely important. This forest has been located where its location. It has been, the government had already had staked it as a important, significant area of sciences and research. And the significance of the forest is important because it's the most ecological area within a city in the world. It's the only city that has this wilderness within a city in the world. And as far as the forest, the only one that could partially compare to it is located in Vancouver, BC, but which is called Stanley Park. But it is very small. It's one-third smaller than this forest in Canada.
Hmm. Very significant. And how hopeful are you that the development will stop?
Well, we've clearly stated, I have clearly stated, that the destruction of this forest is a direct attack to Algonquin First Nation. It's violence. We've very clearly stated it's violence, and violence will not be left unanswered. Now, Grandfather William Kamada, which is one of our foremost elders, he's 97 years old, he says that this is important, that this be seen and as an aboriginal issue only, but it has to be seen as a forest that is sacred within itself and that it has to be preserved for a generation to come, for the children to come.
Okay, and what's going to happen at Queen's Park between now and Sunday?
We have started a sacred fire this morning at around 9 o'clock, and we were here, myself and several other people, and the ceremony started. I started the ceremony with a brother of mine who is a Mohawk, and he also did the sunrise ceremony. So it's it was a beautiful thing to have Algonquins and Mohawks together starting a sacred fire, and also have other unbelievers here. So it's absolutely a very, very good experience.
So I have another question. How did you get clearance to do the fire at Queen's Park?
Well, sometimes prayers and sacred fires are very special, and they're one of the fundamental religious practice of Aboriginal people throughout the world. So we've basically explained that to Queen's Park security and the officers there, and we told them that this is what we were going to do, and we got clearance, no problem.
And is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
Well, we'd definitely like to have, what we are looking for is for Mr. Michael Chan, the Ministry of Culture, to come and talk to us here at the Sacred Fire on Sunday, because he's ultimately responsible for not stopping this massacre.
That was Daniel M. Bernard, Algonquin firekeeper, who spoke with us from the sacred fire burning outside Queen's Park, which began February 9th. Bernard adds, closing ceremonies will be held Sunday, February 13th, where respected Elder William Kamanda will address participants. The finding of the diary of an Ontario Treaty Commissioner points out the discrepancies in a 1905 treaty and what was said between negotiators. James Bay Treaty No. 9 was signed in 1905. Amishagawa Council Grand Chief Stan Ludit spoke with Nation Talk's Andre Morisseau at a gathering earlier this month in Fort Albany, Ontario.
We're gathering here for 3 days to talk about the James Bay Treaty. And why we thought it was important that we do that is because our leaders and our elders have spoken for many, many years about the significance of Treaty No. 9, the James Bay Treaty, and the spirit and intent of the treaty and the oral promises that were promised as part of the treaty-making process. So over this three-day period, we are talking about and hearing presentations from various experts, including our elders, who are telling us how the James Bay Treaty, Treaty No. 9, was made. As well, in recent times, in the past 2 years, lost in the archives of one of the major universities in southern Ontario, I believe it's Queen's, uncovered the personal diaries of one of the treaty commissioners of Treaty No. 9. Not the diaries of the record that make up the actual treaty document, but his own writings in his own handwriting, which reveal very, very interesting facts in terms of how the treaty was presented and how the treaty was understood back in 1905 and 1906. So when we examine that a little bit further, we're finding that the treaty-making process was very, very, very different from what our people heard from the treaty commissioners' mouths, if you will. For the first time in the treaty-making process, Ontario was a party to Treaty No. 9. And Ontario appointed a representative to represent Ontario's interests in the treaty-making process of Treaty No. 9, and the James Bay Treaty. The treaty commissioner appointed by Ontario was Daniel McMartin, a miner from Perth, who kept personal diaries of the proceedings of the James Bay Treaty. And what we're finding is the commissioners federally and the provincial representatives, this treaty document, Treaty No. 9, was prepared well beforehand, probably in the 1903-04 era, by their legal experts and their policy people in Ottawa, prepared to bring to the Cree people of Northern Ontario to have their marks affixed to a treaty document. And what we're finding is when the treaty commissioners came, first of all, they spent very little time in our territory, anywhere from 15 minutes to half a day. And the treaty document was not translated. The treaty document was not given to our people to read, comprehend, understand, and take some time to consume and to look it over. That was not done. And what we're finding is that the treaty document, very legalistic in nature, was not reviewed and was not explained in detail, word per word, during the treaty-making process. For example, one portion of the actual treaty document, which makes reference to our hunting rights and our lands, states in not exactly these terms, but it states that we, as Cree people, can hunt, fish, and gather as we always did in our territories, which is good. Those are good words in the actual treaty document. But there is a taking up clause, is what we refer to that particular section of the treaty. It goes on to say, after it confirms, after it states that we can continue using the lands as we always did, it says, but if the government of the day wishes to take up those lands for mining, forestry, or other purposes, they can do so. Those are the words of the actual treaty document, the James Bay Treaty, Treaty No. 9. And I refer to the diaries of one of the commissioners. This is where the diaries of one of the commissioners, his personal diaries, come in very, 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 very handy and are very, very important in terms of our understanding of the treaty and what it's all about and what was said and what our people understood. So when we look at, when we read through the diaries of the Ontario commissioner, it says in regard to that particular taking up clause that I referred to in the actual treaty document, it says in the handwriting of the Ontario commissioner in his own personal diaries, it says at various places in the treaty making process in our territory, not just one place, but in various places all across the Treaty 9 area, it says you can hunt and fish and gather as in the days of yore, meaning as you always did. There's no buts. It stops there. It doesn't say, but if the government needs it, they can take it. It does not say that. It so just confirms that we can do what we always did in our territories.
And the significance is that it's coming from their actual historical reference. I mean, it was their guy who wrote this. So what's happening is, in all reality, is that there's a big lie going on here, so to speak.
There was a big lie going on. What came out of the mouths of the commissioners and what is actually written in the Treaty 9 James Bay Treaty document is two different things. As indicated and as shown through the personal diaries of one of the commissioners, he wrote down what the commissioners said. So in other words, they said you can hunt and trap and gather as in the days of yore, as you always did. And that was it. And he wrote that down. And that is very, very significant because it's totally contrary to what the actual wording of the treaty document is, which says you can hunt and trap as you always did, but if the government of the day needs it, they can take it. In the personal diaries, it does not say that.
What kind of agreement would that be?
And which confirms what our elders have said all along, that this treaty, the James Bay Treaty, Treaty Number 9, was a treaty that we understood to be one of sharing. Sharing the lands and the wealth of our territories, not for one nation, Canada and Ontario in this case, to be able to take our lands as they please. So this finding of the diaries of the Ontario Commissioner is extremely significant, because now we are able to dissect and digest that new piece of information to help us in our discussions with Canada and Ontario, and to be able to tell not only our people, our youth, our communities, what this all means and what the findings, what they will do in terms of moving forward, but also to engage governments to say, look, what you understand to be what the treaty says in terms of the taken up clause, take a look at this new information.
That was Meshkagawa Council Grand Chief Stan Ludit speaking with Nation Talk's Andre Morisseau. Now here's My Brother by Farrah Palmer.
There'll never be another brother like the one I had. He must have been an angel. He was more than just a man. His laughter I will miss, smile and his kiss. My heart is crying out for you, Gabriel, we miss you. I feel so blessed that God chose me to be your family. And I was told the good die young, but I just can't believe I'll never see your face or feel your warm embrace. My heart is crying out for you, Gabriel, I miss you. But we'll remember the way you were and all the things you did. And we'll remember the unconditioned love you had to give, and how you loved your mother and father, your sisters and your brothers, your family and friends, until the very end. There will never be another Gabriel, my brother.
The Muscadet Organic Growers Co-op and Heifer International Canada are reducing unemployment on two First Nations and supplying healthy food. Joseph Monroe is the Indigenous Peoples Coordinator for Heifer International.
We have a couple of partnerships where there's a growers co-op. We have one in Muscadet First Nation and one in Flying Dust First Nation. They're similar in some respects and dissimilar in other respects. It's a cooperative comprised of band members who want to grow their own natural grown organic food and sell the excess, thereby attempt to make a sustainable livelihood for themselves and get good food to eat.
How long has the project been up and running now?
The group has partnered with Heifer International for the last couple of years. The co-op's been in existence since 2005. And there's other renditions of a market garden in Muscadet previous to that, dating back to 1999.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about Heifer International's part in the project?
Heifer International is a partner. We worked in Hunger and Poverty and Care for the Earth. We support farmers worldwide in hundreds of countries. We're currently in 54 countries. And in Canada, our priority areas, number one is helping create sustainable livelihoods and local food systems. Priority area number two is education and training. Priority area number three is advocacy priority area number four in Canada is institutional change within heifer. Our projects are mainly the first priority area. You know, we're concentrating on that a little more than the rest. And the project in Muscadet is a multi-partner. The First Nation is a partner through the Work Opportunity Program and the Reinvestment Fund to Reduce Child Poverty. The province of Saskatchewan has been a partner in the past, but has ceased to be a partner since 2010. So there's a big gap there that needs to be filled for that partnership. And then Heifer International is a partner, usually providing support in the area of seeds and some training, and many of the other things that the other partners don't provide. We have a unique contribution in that respect, and our contribution is one that is like a living loan. In Heifer International, when we give a gift, we call it a gift in the contribution form, they sign a contract that they'll pass on the gift, having the same impact as the original gift had on them. So that's our unique contribution.
And so what's being grown through the co-op?
The Muscadet Co-op is concentrating on Indigenous foods, indigenous to the Americas, not exclusively, but, you know, they're growing potatoes as a cash crop. You know, the vast majority of the crop are potatoes, potato acres, and the rest is the corn, beans, and squash. They're relearning that. They found evidence, as reported in the National Geographic of September 2010 issue, that corn residue found on the cooking pots of the Cree in northern Saskatchewan, northern Manitoba. So the corn, beans, and squash, and other indigenous crops to the Americas.
Well, that's pretty cool. And in order to sell it around the province, I understand that you need certification. Is any of that going on?
The projects themselves have undertaken to get the certifications. You know, for those markets that require it, that's the organic certification. There are other certifications that are, you know, if they decide to start growing and selling certified organic seed potatoes, which they can do, then they will need Canada Food Inspection Agency certification there as well. And it'll all be market driven. You know, if people hear that they can grow seed potatoes here and they can grow them organic, and they place the order, then they can do it. This group has previously grown seed potatoes that are not organic. They've grown potatoes, you know, they've grown potatoes every which way. They haven't put it all together yet to grow certified organic seed potatoes because of the market not being there yet, or they just haven't discovered it yet. But they've done the different parts. They've worked their way up to it. They've been on a steep learning curve.
Well, I guess when you're starting probably from exactly scratch. And is this project helping reduce the amount of unemployment in Muscadet?
Yes. When the band participates, when the First Nation participates, the welfare follows the participants. For instance, they usually take 10 or 12 people right from the welfare rolls and give them the training, the green certificate training in growing. Growing vegetables and fruit, food and grains, and so the First Nation contributes the welfare through the Work Opportunity Program, and also some additional funds in the form of the Reinvestment Fund to Reduce Child Poverty, because most of the time the participants are parents or young parents, and so that's a direct saving from welfare, direct saving, and the money that the band saves, for instance. If they contribute $65,000, that's the welfare for the 10 people for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Then they save twice that, double that, when these people are on EI, because they immediately go onto EI after the summer. They get enough hours to get onto EI. So somebody saves that money. If it's an FTA band, financial transfer arrangement band, the band saves it and gets to spend it somewhere else. If it's not, the Indian Affairs and thereby the taxpayers of Canada save that money. So it's been advantageous for these groups, these co-ops, to take people right from the welfare rolls and thereby reduce unemployment immediately. As these co-ops grow and expand their market and expand their acres, they have the likely potential of eliminating unemployment in Western Canadian reserves.
And what kind of plans are there to expand the co-op?
Well, if things work out this year and if the marketing comes through, they're expanding their potato acres. They have 60 acres that they would like to plant in Mashkere, if it works out, and they have, there's a total of 500 acres available, so they can put about 120 acres of potatoes on there, which is about $1.6 million if it's certified organic potatoes. So, you know, that's starting to be big business now and wiping out unemployment. So the plans are to use measured growth, you know, grow with the markets and to keep it going if possible.
That was Joseph Monroe, Indigenous Peoples Coordinator for Heifer International. The Women's Memorial March Committee in Vancouver is hoping this year's march will be the biggest yet. The event is heading into its 20th annual march to bring awareness to missing and murdered women. I spoke with Marlene George, chair of the committee, last month, and I thought I would replay that interview for you since the event is coming up close. Marlene George says the march began 2 decades ago under serious circumstances.
In 1991, there was a murder of a sex trade worker, an Aboriginal sex trade worker on Powell Street in Vancouver, and her remains were distributed in various places around the community by the fellow that had murdered her. And her family had gone around and did a cleansing ceremony at each of the sites her remains were found. But for the community, it was the catalyst that moved them into action, and women had decided that they had enough of the violence and murders and assaults of women in the community. So they decided that they were going to hold a march. The murder of the woman happened mid-January, and the march, they decided, was going to be held on February 14th. So that's where it got started from, by the senseless, you know, murders and assaults of women in the community.
So it's been 20 years now, and is there going to be other special events leading up to this one to help educate and bring awareness towards missing and murdered women?
We're planning to have a couple of screenings of the movie of the National Film Board film Finding Dawn by Christine Welsh, a producer, filmmaker. And that'll be, one screening will be at Langara College, and the other will be a community screening on 2nd and Main. We're also organizing an activist session as well, where they'll be viewing the movie and strategizing, because we understand that still some of the women's remains haven't been repatriated with the family members, so they're still being held in the coroner's office, and that's way too long. It's 9 years actually this year that since the Picton case broke. So that's a long time for the remains to be held in the coroner's office.
Mm-hmm.
We're also going to be holding an art auction and a music night. Those would be fundraisers for the 20th Women's Memorial March.
So this has been going on for 2 decades now. And Marlene, has anything changed with respect to the amount of missing and murdered women or people's attitudes?
I think that the numbers of women that are missing certainly has decreased with the arrest of Picton, but certainly there are still Aboriginal women that are continuing to go missing across the nation, and there's still people looking for their family members. There's still 32 women that are unaccounted for on the missing women's official list, so we don't know, you know, are they still active investigations, and considering that Willie Picton is the only person that was ever charged and tried for the murder of missing women. So we know that there are other people that were responsible, but to date there have been no other charges laid.
So you were talking just earlier about community activism. Now, what sort of activities or what does that mean, and what can people do?
Well, interestingly enough, in the downtown east side, at the mid-September, there was a woman that was tossed out the window of the fifth floor of one of the hotels in the downtown east side, Ashley Machisnick. And we had suspected that there were drug dealers that were responsible for her death. We, on the National Day of Action on October the 4th, as part of the Sisters in Spirit campaign, we had held a community memorial for Ashley. And we ended up with a rally outside the Vancouver Police Department. There was a huge turnout of Aboriginal people from Vancouver that attended that. We'd stayed outside the police station for many, many hours, probably about 5 or 6 hours anyway. And three women were arrested and charged with criminal trespass. I believe that those charges have been dropped as of now. But what has happened from that action is that we have regular meetings with the Vancouver Police Department to not only raise the issue around the violence that happens to addicted women in this community, but we also have other concerns around assaults that happen against sex trade workers, and we're able to meet directly with the chief of police on a regular basis every 2 to 3 weeks and talk about the violence against women in this community.
Okay, so there has been some improvement with police, it sounds like.
Yeah, we're starting to build those bridges with the police, so at least that they know what we're dealing with and the things that we're hearing that are whatever's happening to women, that we're able to. They had actually set up a tip line for women who have experienced violence so that they have a direct line to the Vancouver Police Department to be able to offer tips anonymously and have some follow-up done.
Well, that's interesting. And what are you hoping to come from this coming March? And do you think numbers will be high this year?
I think that given we have 2 weeks of events following up to the march, that the numbers will be higher. And we also have the public inquiry for the missing women. It's in process now. And those are other... We hope to have some kind of outcome from that missing women inquiry, not only for the women of the Downtown East Side, but it's also going to be relevant to the Highway of Tears, the missing women from the Highway of Tears. We have also got sister marches happening across Canada in Victoria and Prince George, Edmonton, Calgary, and both Toronto and a few other places back east. So it is getting larger. It's getting more recognized as a national day of action for violence against women.
That was Marlene George, chair of the Women's Memorial March Committee in Vancouver. Now here's Looks Like Change to Me from Ceremony.
We've had lots of time now. Take up our minds now. Indecision, we've got to kill this division. A change will bring about the end. Now it's time to get out, get in, let's get round of the skin and sing. Hey, hey, come get your freedom, get back into the rhythm. It's time for us believers to say, hey, hey, hey.
Ceremony has a very diverse sound, and the band's music includes all sorts of genres from rock to rap to reggae. And Ceremony is one of 5 bands that have been nominated for a Juno in the Aboriginal Album of the Year category. Matt Eiserhoff of Ceremony spoke with Bonsida.
Well, the name Ceremony, it encompasses what many creeds, beliefs, and religions and around the world and felt that, you know, every religion, every creed, every belief has ceremonies, and we felt that it was universal in that aspect. And for us, we're trying to promote as well with some of the music that we write is to create a broader understanding of who we are as First Nations people, not just Cree, but First Nations in general, and to have an understanding of where we've come from in terms of our spiritual backgrounds and our cultural backgrounds and our languages. So that's what we felt, you know, that this name would be able to encompass, and at the same time, it's such a universal thing, because for all ceremonies, what do they do? Is they unify people, regardless if you're going to a service at church, or you go to a certain ceremony of the First Nations, or you're going to a synagogue. Everyone unites, and for this, it creates a broader understanding. We are as individuals, I guess.
And that's brilliant. And like speaking of your name and then about ceremony unifying people, I find that your music would unify crowds and people because it's so diverse. And I can't think of any one category that the music would go into because it goes from rap to rock and then something like reggae fusion in Round and Round. And do you want to tell us more about your music?
Yeah, that was the intention. You know, as we always say when we're writing songs, it doesn't matter what direction it goes in terms of the genre itself, whether it's a reggae song like Round and Round or First Sun, which is a lot of hip-hop fusion in there as well, to, you know, straightforward rock and roll of Our Guns on the album. And, you know, you have the slower acoustic, which is Reaction. You know, we felt that, you know, this is what we felt, you know, we could try and convey with the music that we did. And therefore not, you know, putting us into one particular genre. We're trying to, you know, whatever the feel of the lyrics, whatever the feel of the sound would be, that's what we were going to put on tape. It was something that we initially, you know, had in mind when we started working on the project for future projects.
Cool. And the other thing I'm asking everybody is, while, you know, a Juno nomination is nothing to sneeze at, and congratulations on that. And the other thing I'd like to know is, do you think just being in the Aboriginal recording category is, does the group, or do you guys feel pigeonholed by that?
At the moment, I think it's a big step for Junos to recognize Aboriginal artists and the music that they create. But, you know, in light of what the category looks at, of course, you know, in the future for Ceremony, for instance, we would like, you know, to get further into other categories of the industry, as well as other, you know, when it comes to awards such as the Junos, to get that and garner that kind of respect as well. And not to say that respect is not there already, but I think it is a big step that it's being recognized at that level already. And I think a lot of the music, you listen to Joey Styles or Derek Miller, their range in terms of the genres of music that they convey with their recordings, you could tell that a lot of it is made for mainstream, and that, you know, they're trying to get their message out, not just to the Indigenous people or First Nations people, but to the mainstream. And I think that's what's important, and then this is a step towards that. And we feel honored to be a part of that category at the same time, you know. But I think it's, as the music industry progresses, a lot of that music is going to start to, you know, seep into these different categories, Album of the Year and all that. And I think that's something that a lot of First Nations artists should strive for, because I think that's where we all want to be. We want that kind of recognition, particularly with certain messages that, you know, some artists may have, and some of them are very strong. And I think that kind of recognition is important to get from that level of the music industry as well.
Yeah, well, there's certainly precedents already there with Susan Aglukkaq and Buffy St. Marie and Robbie Robertson.
Yes, exactly. You know, and they've broadened the genre more. You know, and I think it's because of their tireless efforts over the years in getting the music out there. You know, you had Buffy St. Marie in the '60s. Working with a lot of major artists, you know, like Leonard Cohen and such, it's amazing to see that, you know, already that's how far the First Nations music has gone, you know, and to be a part of an industry where it is difficult for First Nations to try and get the music out there. You know, you have a handful of artists that are gaining that recognition, but, you know, you got to look at the broader picture at the same time. There is so much talent in the world, including First Nations people. And I think that's what's important, that we're getting closer and closer to that step to get that kind of recognition further.
Okay, and well, that's actually everything from me, Matt. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. We're obviously really humbled by the Juno nomination. It's quite an amazing step for the group, and, you know, we wish to congratulate all the other nominees in that particular category, as well as other nominees that are in the other categories at the Junos. It's to be a part of that long list of nominees, it's quite an honor, and you know, we accept it in a sense of humility and humbleness.
That was Matt Eiserhoff of Ceremony, one of six bands nominated for a Juno in the Aboriginal Album of the Year category. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.